This is HPR episode 1894 entitled, Interview with David Zilli and Dr. Marion Sinker of the Humbug Project. It is hosted by Ken Fallon and is about 61 minutes long. The summary is, mosquito detection and habitat mapping for improved malaria modeling.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by anhonesthost.com. Get 15% discount on all shared hosting with the offer code HPR15. That's HPR15. Better web hosting that's honest and fair at anhonesthost.com.
Hi everybody, my name is Ken Fallon, and you're listening to another episode of Hacker Public Radio. Today we have an interview for you, and it stems from a blog post that I wrote over on my own website called Open Source Mosquito Locator. And basically what I tried to do in the post was find a way to locate mosquitoes, because all the things that I've seen up until now has been ways to destroy mosquitoes, but it's the location that seems very interesting to more interesting to me. And then after that, once you know where they are, you can identify the species and you can eliminate them if that's what you want to do. And this stems from my kids having a very bad reaction to getting bit by mosquitoes. I don't know if people know, but the Netherlands is covered in mosquitoes, something I didn't know until I was A, married, and B, moved over here. Not that that would have in any way influenced my decision, but mosquitoes though are a bit of a problem. They're a massive big problem in certain areas where there is malaria, and this is with the importation of things like car tires with little bits of water in it. Every year that's beginning to come into certain areas of Europe as well. So it's a fairly serious thing. Mosquitoes are the number one killer of humans in the world, and of everything, I believe. But it could be completely wrong. So lots of that blog post, lots of comments, and one comment by Alexander Azali, who pointed me to humbug.robots.ox.ac.uk, which I'm guessing is an academic institute in Oxford with something to do with robots. And I contacted that project, and that project, they were very kind to come on and talk to us today. So if you could both introduce yourselves, that would be fantastic.
Okay, I'll start. I'm David. I'm a researcher on the Humbug project. As you said, it's a project at the University of Oxford. It's a collaboration actually between the Royal Botanic Gardens Kew and the Information Engineering Department in Oxford. And yes, we started about 6 months ago with this project, which is funded by a Google Impact Award. And the target of this project is really to detect and classify different species of mosquitoes. But I'll let Marianne introduce herself, and then we can say more about the project.
Okay. Hi, I'm Marianne Sinker. I'm also working on exactly the same project full time. It's the idea behind the project is that may be able to distinguish between different species of mosquito by the sound of their wing beat frequency. So basically the little buzz that you hear when you know you're just about to be bitten, that little noise. And so what the project was we were going to see if we could work out whether we could use that noise and we could use other information such as, you know, the surrounding vegetation. And that's why Q's involved. And just mosquitoes. I'm a mosquito researcher. I've spent about 10 years looking at malaria vectors and trying to find out where they are and how they behave, because they all can behave quite differently. And there's a lot more species than people realise. And we're trying to put all of this together to make a useful sensor where we can map controlling them, also to alert people to the fact that there might be a mosquito that may be carrying a certain disease in their vicinity. I think I'll hand back to David to give you a bit more of the technological.
And why did you get into studying mosquitoes in the first place?
I've got a background in entomology. I've always looked at my PhD was looking at insect interactions. So just looking to see how insect herbivores affect the insects that live in the soil. There's an interaction. So basically you get insects affect a plant in just different ways, and that affects what goes on in the soil. The plant responds to different. So if you if a caterpillar chews a leaf, the plant will respond in a different way to if an aphid pierces the leaf and tries to suck out the leaf juice. That has a different effect on what goes on in the soil. So that was my kind of beginning, and I've always been interested in themselves and ecology, and then I managed to get a postdoc in Oxford looking at mapping different disease vectors, and there's a lot of disease and there's a lot of mosquitoes that carry them,
absolutely no problem.
And that's my one-year-old.
Congrats,
boy or
girl?
That's Elsie, little girl. Very happy.
Excellent.
I lost my train of thought a little bit there. So basically I've had my in insect research, but I've also always been very interested in the medical side of things, be able to combine the two, looking at insects and looking at, you know, the disease, and actually making it have a little bit more I'd say, you know, a little bit more importance, a little bit more focus in why you're actually looking at a particular insect. And mosquitoes are surprisingly are quite understudied when it comes to vectoring disease, which is quite surprising.
I would have thought given the number of fatalities, that it would have been more researched.
Well, what has happened is I think people initially considered mosquitoes to be fairly simple organisms, which they are. But there is a kind of little extra bit of complexity that hasn't been factored in. And I think that most people who initially started looking at things like malaria, dengue and stuff, the focus was on the disease. So the focus was on the malaria parasite or on the dengue virus. And the mosquito was considered just to be, you know, the vessel that carried this disease from, you know, one person to another and not much else. In more recent years, people have realized that, you know, this is actually very important to understand these mosquitoes. There are, you know, in the literature, there's people who've spent, you know, their entire careers just trying to try and focus on one particular species. The one of the main problems is the fact that it's quite difficult to tell some of these species apart. So you can have two species of mosquito that look absolutely identical. Perhaps there might be different ridges in the eggs, but if you were to look really, really carefully, you might be able to distinguish between the two species. But other than that, they are morphologically identical, but they behave very differently. So one would be an extremely dangerous vector of disease. The other one would have no interest in biting people at all, and would only, for example, you know, bite cows, for example. So people have done, you know, they've been working on these things, but they haven't been able to fully identify them until more recently, when we've had the kind of techniques, the DNA techniques, to be able to, you know, pull these apart and say this is definitely a different species. This species is definitely behaving differently. This one is not a danger. This one is. We need to focus our control efforts on this dangerous one and ignore this other one. If that makes sense.
Makes 100% sense. However, here I do need to interject with the question. Well, why not just get rid of all mosquitoes?
Because how would you do it?
Yeah, exactly. Well, but then I could put the same question to you, right? We identified this one species that we want to target. Then how do we get rid of that one as well? It's the same question. You know, you could just carpet bomb the place with DDT and get rid of all the mosquitoes and all the other. Yeah, I'm playing devil's advocate a little bit here, but, you know, a mosquito is a mosquito is a mosquito. Kill all the mosquitoes and we've solved the problem.
Yes, if you kill all the mosquito, you will have solved the problem. But it just is. I mean, there are massive campaigns out in wherever there is malaria for people to try and stop the mosquitoes. So what they do is they try and stop the specific mosquitoes, because if you wanted to kill all mosquitoes, you would have to treat or deal with every water body that there is. So mosquitoes will be found everywhere in the world, apart from, I think, you know, in the deepest Arctic and Antarctic, everywhere in the world, everywhere that there's water. If you, if there's any place where there's water, there have been times where people have desperately tried to deal with all the mosquitoes. I remember hearing one story from a colleague, and they'd gone out, and I think it was actually in an area where they were just trying to deal with all these mosquitoes, and they couldn't work out where the mosquitoes were coming from. They had treated all the water bodies, all the obvious water bodies that they could find, and then eventually they found that the mosquitoes were breeding in a golf course, in the little holes where the balls go. So you to, I mean, when we're talking about, you have to search out every little bit of water, you have to search out every puddle, you have to search out every little bit of water that's in every tree hole, every little bit of water that's in, that's caught in, if you've got a, you know, some plant pots in your garden, every bit of water that's in those plant pots. When the rain comes in places in Africa, it just takes moments, you know, exaggeration, it takes days for the mosquitoes to find, lay,
and breed,
emerge and come out. So in a few days after the rains, you have the mosquitoes coming, and it's just a huge problem. And also, obviously, you have the ecological kind of impact. If you were to go and wipe out every mosquito, there would be a kind of follow-on impact. But what they're trying to do is they're trying to wipe out the ones that bite the people by putting out bed nets over the people that are treated with insecticides, or spraying inside people's houses with insecticides.
Okay, have you gone silent there for a sec?
Got it.
Okay, so they try to treat it just locally in the house and make mosquito-free zones in houses. And I understand as well the supply of mosquito nets are helping quite a lot. But what makes you think then that if you can identify a mosquito that you can eradicate it?
Because the idea is, if you can identify where you've got the mosquitoes that are carrying the disease, you can focus your efforts and your money in the right place, first instance, because, as I said, you know, different mosquitoes will behave in different ways and be able to transmit. And also, the other idea behind the sensor is to understand the mosquito better, to say, what is the surrounding vegetation that this mosquito is associated with? Let's understand a little bit more about the ecology of the mosquito. What are the very local climatic conditions that are found with this mosquito?
So if they're attracted to...
another daughter there, sorry.
How old is she?
She's three.
Wow, you're right in the middle of a sleepless night, I bet.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. lost train of thought.
Then you can
basically focus your money, and you can understand a bit more about the species.
Take it down, no rush. We can have long pauses of silence if you want, and because we can truncate that out without any problem whatsoever. So if you need to go away for a few minutes, absolutely no problem.
Okay, thank you. Go back to what I was saying. One of the issues now is that the bed nets and the insect spraying inside houses is wiping out the main important carriers, the ones that have been doing the biggest transmission of the disease. But there are other species that are still able to transmit the disease, but they're the ones that don't come in and bite people indoors, so they won't be affected by a bed net over someone when they're sleeping, and they don't rest on the inside of a wall in a house, so they won't be affected if you spray the inside of a house with DDT or whatever, or an insecticide. They hang about outside. So understanding what species are where, identifying them properly, identifying whether you've got species that are outside biters or indoor biters, means that you know, do I spend all my money on bed nets, or do I spend all my money on trying to find other ways to deal with these mosquitoes? Is this mosquito a mosquito that will bite people and cows? If you can spray cows with insecticide. There's lots of interesting and new and different methods of trying to control them, but you really need to know what you're dealing with before you can do it effectively.
Absolutely. Cool stuff. So, like, it could be as simple as, you know, they're attracted to plant X, so move plant X as far away from people as possible.
Exactly. The mosquitoes, they feed on plant nectar to give them energy. They feed the females feed on blood to allow the eggs to develop. Males feed on nectar only, and the females feed on nectar for the energy to fly about in that kind of everyday life. So we're trying to find out if there is any association between any specific plants and these mosquitoes.
Okay, fantastic. Thank you very much.
And there is also another side to it, if I can add, that if we understand a bit more about the relationship between the mosquito and the vegetation that they like, we can hopefully relate it to subtler imagery of the vegetation and model outbreaks of the malaria disease and hopefully predict the outbreaks as well.
Oh, very interesting. Very interesting.
So this is the side that the Kew Gardens are looking to more, because they have the background on the plant species and also the expertise and the GIS and the kind of geographer expertise to relate these two things together. And hopefully together then we can model and create some models to predict the outbreaks.
Okay. David, if you could explain to us what your background is and how you got into the project.
Sure. My background is actually in computer science, but I also was always interested in insects and in insect sounds, I guess, because my PhD was had to do with the New Forest cicada. We run this project in around the New Forest, the national park, just southwest of Southampton, and the project was trying to detect the presence of this very endangered cicada, the only species that we have in the UK. And
so what's a cicada?
A cicada is a sort of like a grasshopper or a cricket. It's very similar, although belonging to a different order, is similar to a cricket, let's say. And it's an insect that it's very common around Europe and the rest of the world, but it likes warm climate, so it is not so common in the UK. In fact, the only species ever found is this species called the New Forest cicada that lives on the south coast, and it was only ever found in the New Forest. That's hence the name.
Oh, cool.
And it emits this really, really high-pitched sound that is very loud, but it's so high-pitched that most of adults really struggle to hear it because it's at the edges of our hearing range. And so we run this citizen science project where we created a smartphone app to detect the presence of this cicada, and all the visitors around the New Forest, or lots of visitors, downloaded the app and helped us rediscover this species, which is going extinct. And unfortunately, we haven't found it yet, but the project is still running, I guess. So I guess this is a bit of a long way to say that my background is in computing systems, but with an interest in sound, especially in insect sounds.
Okay, very good. And on the website there, you have so there's three different sections under the project research area.
Yes.
So I guess you would be the smart acoustic sensor.
Yes. So my side of the project is on the acoustic sensing. Yes. So what we're doing now is we're developing both a hardware prototype and some algorithms for recording and detecting the presence of these mosquitoes. And the first challenge with that is to get a great big data set of mosquito sounds that we can train algorithms on. These algorithms need quite a lot of data to understand what the features are that we want to extract from the signal. And once we understand very well from all the different species that we want to classify, then we can refine the accuracy of the algorithm. And this, the algorithm at the moment, we have it deployed in a simple version of the algorithm that we have so far, is running in an app for a smartphone that I think you can see on the website as well. And what that app is at the moment is not for public use. It's just for us to record, to go around to researchers that have mosquito cultures and record different species and different sounds. And obviously, mosquito sounds vary a lot with with lots of different parameters, in particular the age of the mosquito, the gender, if it's male or female, the humidity of the environment, and if the female is blood fed or not blood fed. So there are lots of things that can make the sound of a mosquito vary, and we have to get a big data set of all these recordings of all different circumstances for as many species as possible, and that's a first step.
I guess this is why Google got involved.
Yes, so I think so this is the this was initially Google have this impact challenges. Basically they fund projects, charities, and just generally projects that they have an impact on something that is, I guess, quite societal change. And we applied about a year ago, I think, or maybe a year and a half ago, and we went through all the stages of the interview, and in the end we got this funding that they can help us with this project.
So you say this isn't... Sorry, go on ahead.
Oh, sorry, I was just going to just jump in. Yeah, with the Google Impact Challenge, what they do is they have a lot of people put in applications for it, and they funded, I think it was 10 projects in the end, and ours was one of those 10. And it seems that what they do is they look for kind of innovation and something unusual. And the great value to this is the fact that they will fund projects that perhaps other funders would not consider because there's a risk involved, and so it's actually a really, really good source of funding for us at this stage of the project when we're looking at something that's very, very novel, and that it's difficult to implement, but you know, that we're hoping to kind of achieve. But basically Google, this particular funding source is unusual in the fact that it will fund and it will take a chance on something unusual.
And are there any requirements on them? I mean, will you be releasing the source code, or will you be making this device publicly available so that other people can use it, or how does that work?
Yeah, I think target. I don't know if it's a requirement or not. I think something we might have to check into. But definitely, as a research project for us, we will be very happy to make this open source. But the algorithms will definitely be published, if anything, and the app will be made available open source. And more importantly, maybe in my opinion, is the data set that we are collecting, so that everyone can try to have a go at developing different algorithms. I think that's the big thing for me, and that we will also be making open.
Oh, fantastic. If we could just go through the habitat modeling and the vector modeling pages, because the acoustic sensor, I kind of get from our background here, it's but I do want to come back to that. But I wonder, could you give me an overview of what the habitat mapping, what the benefit of that is, and the vector modeling?
Can I just with the vector modeling, the text there, I'm just rewriting the text that will go on the vector modeling page, that will just kind of underline that what we're doing and how we're using occurrence data to be able to previously how I've done it and how I intend to do it, use occurrence data to and covariates such as the climate, such as the plant species, such as the kind of flowers that are around, to try and do niche models. I don't know if you know models, where basically you use lots of occurrence data where you have identified.
And when you say occurrence data, you mean?
Pardon?
When you say occurrence data, what do you mean exactly?
Oh, sorry, occurrence data. So basically, when you've got a confirmed idea of where a species is. It doesn't necessarily have to be a mosquito, but a particular species. So if you're doing niche modeling, what you need is you need to know the exact location of a confirmed identification of that species.
Gotcha.
So you've got all the lat longs for the various different sites, so you can actually map them. You can put lots and lots of dots on a map, and then what you can do at each of those specific locations, particularly using satellite data or other data that spreads across or remote sensing data or weather data or whatever you have that spreads across that area, and kind of drill down at each of those locations and say, in this location, what is the climate, what is the land cover, what is humidity, what's the normal rainfall, etc., etc., etc. And then you can say each of these occurrence points that I have, these are locations, what's the commonality between all of these points? What is it that this species is looking for?
So you're looking for and then plant X.
And then
basically.
What you do,
you're looking for this famous plant X or a combination of factors
you're looking for its niche, basically.
Gotcha. Yeah, this mosquito needs all these things in order to survive.
Exactly. And then what you can then do is you can look using the habitat surfaces that we have. So satellite data, for example. Say, well, where else do these specific conditions exist that we have identified in each of those locations that we found the species? Where else do these particular conditions exist? Then we can say that it's quite likely that you will also find the species in this area, unless there has been some sort of intervention that has prevented either the species getting there. So, you know, maybe there's a mountain range, something from where the species originally kind of evolved. It's never managed to get to this particular place. Or, you know, has it been its mosquitoes? Would it have been there if people hadn't already sprayed insecticide? So what you could do is you can identify what's called a fundamental niche, which is basically all the locations where the species would exist under ideal conditions.
Yeah, gotcha. And ideally, if you're getting lucky, if this was a Sunday night movie, for instance, you would find some sort of insect or other that is eating the mosquitoes in that other area. And then you could do all sorts of interesting things.
I think because what they in some areas in Asia, for example, you get a lot of mosquitoes that breed in rice fields. So what they do in the rice fields is they release certain fish species, and the fish eat the mosquito larvae, and then when they drain the water out of the paddy fields to collect up the rice, they also collect up the fish. So it's just a really neat system of getting your rice and getting your fish at the same time.
So this is real actual science at work here.
Yeah.
Very, very, very impressive. The amount of data that you're going to need to do this, though, is going to be phenomenal.
Yes. Yes, it is. But I think Davide will either agree or disagree. I don't know. But I feel that once we've managed to get the system set up, it should be kind of self-perpetuating. So we should be able to use our sensors to gather our data for us and increase our data set and use that data set to refine our sensors. So it should be a kind of continual circle. So we kind of put out some sensors, and they are discovering a different sound of a mosquito in a different area. And the next place we found another different sound, another different area. And we keep collecting this and keep collecting it and collecting all the data. And then we can kind of analyze the data and find the associations. And then once we've found the associations and we're saying there's likely to be a different species in this area than this area, we can go out and start collecting it. And also, in addition to using the sensor, in a previous project, I went through lots and lots of literature that's available where people have reported where they've collected different species. And so what they do is they normally give the site and they normally give the coordinates. And I've extracted all that information and mapped it and created some of these niche models. So we are kind of trying to refine these niche models. And then what we can do is we can try and associate sensor data with the niche model outputs and see if we can find a pattern. And then we can see if we are able to distinguish between them, and if we are able to pick up different niches and different conditions that each species is occurring in.
So you have other sources of information, so like satellite imagery. Where is that coming from?
Well, there's a huge amount of open source satellite imagery that is just available to anyone and everyone. Quite a lot of the NASA satellites produce lots of these kind of grids and look at the satellites are continuously kind of circling and collecting all this information, and all this information is just there to be downloaded. It just takes a bit of processing to just I say that it takes a bit of processing. I know it takes a lot of processing for people who have to do it, but I always get the end results. So it's easy to say a bit of processing, but yeah, it takes a lot of computing power to download all this stuff. Clean it up a little bit, try and remove, because obviously the satellite can't see through clouds, so you have to kind of work out what's going underneath the clouds and reinterpret it. Then you have to kind of try and put the clouds back in again because clouds can be an important climatic factor that we need to consider. So yes, it's actually a lot of processing involved, but all of this stuff is freely available, and there's lots of software to help people. But within in Oxford, there are a lot of people working on these things, mapping.
Okay.
And most of this stuff is freely available, even post-processing.
And one thing that Marianne just touched upon, I think, is very interesting. The fact that this satellite images are stripped of the cloud coverage because they try to find ways to remove the cloud coverage, because that's something that is impedes, you know, seeing what you'd like to see. But actually at the end they realized that in many ways the amount of cloud is important as a climatic factor. So it's the information that it has to be put in again to understand what kind of climate is in that area in that part of the year. So I think it's a fascinating problem that people try to find it as a challenge, you know, a problem to have this cloud coverage over the images. And then actually that's something that when you manage to remove it somehow, then you have to consider it again, because it's an important factor actually.
Excellent. That's fascinating stuff. So tell us about the smart acoustic sensor, which is the thing that I personally am very interested in.
Yeah, so Marianne said I either going to disagree or agree with her. I fully agree that that's what we're trying to do, so to get the sensors to do the work for us, to collect the data in a very distributed way. And the challenge is that the mosquitoes are incredibly quiet, as you know. It might not seem quiet when it's annoying you at night, but in general, obviously, you can only hear a mosquito when he's a few centimeters away from you, even in a quiet room. So what we have so far is a small prototype sensor. You can see, we don't have a picture of it on the website, but if you go to soundtrap.io, that's soundtrap.io, that's the project where we developed these sensors. And these are low cost, low power acoustic sensors, acoustic loggers. So they have a very cheap microphone and a cheap embed microprocessor, and they record and log to an SD card. So that's one side of it, and that's developed by Professor Alex Rogers here at University of Oxford as well.
Just give me one second, I'll give people the specs. It's a 67 megahertz LPC1768 processor, wide recordings to SD card, 48,000 samples per second, powered by three AAA batteries. It's got a microphone and measures 50 by 38 by 12 millimeters and configured over a USB interface, onboard real-time clock. Cool.
Fantastic. And so this is not as low power as it goes. Obviously, you will know that we could make it a lot more low power, but there is a PhD student at Southampton University, where both me and Alex Rogers were before, that is looking at a next generation of this logger. And these loggers are actually not used just for mosquitoes, but we're using this PhD student is using them for logging other events, other acoustic events, like illegal logging. And this is logging in a different sense, in a different meaning of the word. Illegal logging in the forest in Belize. So there are other scenarios where these same sensors could be used. And the challenge, as I said, is that is how far can we hear a mosquito? How far from the device does it have to be from the microphone? And I mean, there's no definitive answer, because it depends on the background noise more than anything, and different things. But you know, you only have a few centimeters to catch the sound. But the good thing is that mosquitoes actually use sound to communicate, so there is, it's obviously a very good way of detecting them. You may know that they use sound for mating purposes. So they choose a partner with a sound. They try to match in frequency. The mosquito of the opposite gender, and sometimes when if they can't match in frequency because their size is too different, and so the frequency is too different, then they will match at a common harmonic, which is something I find incredibly sweet. And they will, for example, match at a third harmonic of one and the second harmonic of the other. And
wow.
So yeah, so it's something that is actually quite refined in the system. Is the organ that is responsible for their hearing is called the Johnson organ. And there are researchers, like some of the researchers have been helping us a lot, like Professor Gay Gibson in University of Greenwich, that has been studying mosquitoes and their sound for a long time.
If you could then emit the sounds of, you could use that sound emission then as a trap or a lure to get mosquitoes onto the device?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. It's been shown that mosquitoes actually respond also to a pure tone of the opposite gender, of the same frequency of the opposite gender. So luring them would be absolutely a great... it would be a great way. There are other ways to lure mosquitoes. They are attracted to light, as you probably know. They are attracted to CO2 because they see that as an animal, yeah, an animal breathing. And so a combination of these things is what normally is used as a trap for mosquitoes. So many of the mosquito traps that are commercially available would have a light and a fan blowing on some dry ice to generate some CO2. We've got some of our sensors deployed in the close to these traps in Wallingford, close to Oxford. With the help of the Centre for Ecology and Hydrology, and the problem for us is that these fans obviously make a noise that is is quite loud compared to the mosquito. So yes, that's one of our challenges, exactly.
What we hope is one of the previous Google Impact Challenges, I think it was the year before ours, was a group of people who were putting together these solar lamps that they hope to distribute across Africa. So it was to allow people that don't have access to electricity to be able to read or kind of continue their life after dark, as we kind of consider to be quite easy to do. One of the guys in our Humbug group was speaking to one of their guys, and we are hoping that we might potentially be able to put one of our sensors on one of their lights. The idea being that we can, by combining these two, we have light, they'll be using the light, we'll have someone sitting there reading or whatever they're doing, producing carbon dioxide. They are basically going to be a massive target for any mosquitoes in the area. And therefore, we will be able to kind of collect this information and at the same time, provide them with information saying, yes, there are dangerous mosquitoes in this area. You need to protect yourself. Most people and in most places in sub-Saharan Africa know that there are dangerous mosquitoes.
Yeah.
But,
you could theoretically change the color of the light or something. Okay.
Yes, that would be a very good idea.
And turn it on the laser. Problem is, people get carried away. It's the identification that's the hard problem.
This flashing red and blue light.
Okay, sorry, got way late there. This device, though, why build a specific device? Why not integrate it into, I don't know, a smartphone or something like a Raspberry Pi or something even cheaper?
Yes, absolutely. Two things. One is that we also are integrating it into a smartphone. The other side of it is that we have this app that I was saying that can record and analyze a bit of the sound with the initial version of the algorithm and tell us if there is a mosquito around or not. And that
that's on the device itself.
That's on the smartphone itself, yes.
Okay.
And that's the kind of picture that you see on the acoustic sensing on page of the website, and that is actually the cheapest option, because we are using this Alcatel Pop C1 smartphones that run Android 4.2, and we can buy them from an EE shop for £9.99. So that is
awesome.
Very difficult to beat when you develop a custom hardware. It's got a screen, 3G, Wi-Fi, a fairly powerful CPU, everything that you could possibly, well, obviously a microphone. If you were to put all these components together yourself, then it would be very difficult to beat it.
Just out of personal interest.
Sure, this is an EE shop, at an absolutely high street shop. Nothing special. We don't have any particular deal with Alcatel. I suppose they are heavily subsidized by EE, but still, you can get them with a SIM card for only £10, basically.
Wow, cool.
I lost my train of thought as well. These devices are very good. The acoustic loggers, we can manufacture them for about £25 at cost with all the components. So,
oh, cool.
It's probably still cheaper than. An Arduino or something similar. A Raspberry Pi would be good, but it's also a bit more. It will require a bit more power, I suppose. And we're hoping to get this down to very, very, very low power.
I think Karen.
Go for it.
Oh, I was just about to say that I think as kind of we all know that and you may have already said this. Sorry, I have removed some Lego from the smartphones in themselves are just this ideal, tiny, already made bit of kit that has everything you need in it. It's got the GPS in it, it's got the recording system in it, it's got the ability to do the analysis on all already in there. Whereas things like the Raspberry Pi, you have to add on all these peripherals. You keep adding on, and every bit you add on adds more cost, every little bit you do. So all of these things have been trialed by someone else on a different project to try and trying all the different ways to do various different monitoring. It all kind of came down to, let's just use something that's already there, like a tiny little computer that someone has already built, and they can build it far cheaper than anything that we can do. And that is, you know, your common smartphone.
Okay, and then why specifically then the Soundtrap.io project, if you can get smartphones for so cheap?
Well, I guess power is the main reason behind that we can make these devices that are low power enough that they can last for months on 3 AA batteries, and hopefully with a very small solar panel they could run indefinitely even, which is not impossible with the phones either. I mean, one of the people we collaborate with is Russ Layberry, who also happens to be Marianne's partner, he's in Oxford researching and doing research on energy, and he is the one who introduced us to this fantastic Alcatel phones. But he also ran a project over in Oxford, powering one of these phones of a solar panel that you can buy on Amazon, off the on a rooftop of Oxford building, so of a winter. So, you know, it's not impossible to power these devices for a long time as well. He ran it for 6 months just off that solar panel. So it's not impossible.
If you can get phones for £10, then you're winning.
Basically you need different devices for different situations, I think, is the idea that so obviously if we can get lots of people to download an app and on their own phones, that's fantastic. We can also deploy our own phones as ways of measuring, but sometimes you just do need to have something a bit more bespoke for what you need, and that's why we're kind of developing the sensors. So we've got we've got two avenues to try. And I think, and again, David will agree or disagree, that with the bespoke one, even though it's going to be more costly, you can tweak it a little bit more, as in put it in a better microphone, put in, you know, you can actually make it the ideal, and then we can see what we can kind of replicate with the phones. Well,
yeah, I guess.
So just kind of try and do two different ways to do it, and seeing what works best.
The one thing about the ARM embedded device, how do you know where that physically is, and how do you collect the data from that?
Sorry, could you say that again?
Yeah, your connection just went a bit Xylon there on us. But with the ARM embedded device, the Soundtrap.io, it doesn't appear to have a GPS module, and it doesn't appear to have an internet connection. So you would physically, a researcher would need to physically drop it somewhere, make note of where it is, and then go back and collect the data from time to time.
That's right. Unfortunately, the limitation of that device.
David, you sound odd.
Can you just disconnect and reconnect again?
Sure. Is it better now?
Yeah, much better.
Okay, great. I might have... I'm not sure if I saved the recording, actually, so...
No, that's fine. I have it.
Let me just start it again, just in case.
Cool, carry on.
That is a limitation of the device, unfortunately. But we could add a GPS or a GSM module, maybe. I mean, a data connection would be very costly, and possibly also not available in the places where we would like to deploy it, both in a forest in Belize or around the places where we would like to monitor malaria. I don't know if we will get a good internet connection. Certainly, or most likely not a Wi-Fi anyway. But with a small GSM module as well, that could be done via text message or something. Unfortunately, obviously, all these components add to the cost and to the energy cost.
But I think here the approach you have is, like, we've got one device that would be there, but could be put by a park ranger somewhere who will go around and then collect the data. And then the other devices are for where the people who already have smartphones, or
Absolutely.
This is a smartphone. So that sounds like an ideal plan. Have you ever considered, like, making the requirements available on the internet so that, like, I at home with my electronic devices here, I do have a Raspberry Pi, I do have an internet connection, and I could then, you know, start adding that sort of information up to a public site.
There's something we haven't considered yet, but I don't see why not, actually. It sounds like a very good idea. That's something we should think about it, yes. The Soundtrap.io is also aiming to be open hardware. Alex Rogers is the person who develops it, so I don't want to speak for him until he's done it, but I think that the final idea is to make that open as well, so that people can replicate it easily at home.
I might actually contact him and see if we can get him on for an interview as well.
Yes, absolutely, he will be happy to.
Cool, excellent. So how long do you have the funding for? Is it for a year, or is it for more longer term?
No, so the funding is for 3 years, and as it is now, we've got just over 2 years left, and that's the initial funding, and it's not unlikely that we will find funding to continue this work for the longer term.
It seems like an absolutely excellent project, and something that obviously I agree that we need to be doing.
Thank you.
If people are interested in this, obviously you can go to the website. Do you update the social network with your project? Where do you keep updates, and or do we wait for the paper to come out?
Yes, that's something we should also be a bit more active about. At the moment, we have a Twitter handle, but we haven't actually used it yet. And so I think we will update our website with a news section. We can keep our people up to date, and people can subscribe to it. But yes, unfortunately, at the moment, I have to say not yet.
No problem.
And I think it's, it's actually very important for this, a project like this, that we do try and get a lot of people interested in it, because I think once we do have everything set up as we want, we manage to get our algorithms on available for an app for a smartphone in a way that we're willing to kind of trial and distribute. Obviously, the more people we can distribute it, the more people who we can get to have a go with it, the better, and the more our data set will be improved, and the more the whole outcome will be improved. So yeah, I think we do need to be a bit better on our website.
Absolutely. No, so I think when people think of mosquitoes, right, they're thinking of poor areas in Africa and swamped regions of the world, but it's not just limited to that, is it? I mean, obviously here in the Netherlands we have mosquitoes, but you mentioned that you have this going in the UK. Are there mosquitoes in the UK as well?
Oh yeah, there's plenty of mosquitoes in the UK. And in fact, there's even mosquitoes that have the capacity to transmit malaria in the UK. And wow. Malaria used to exist in the UK. It was basically malaria is a disease of kind of poverty, and when a country is able to kind of develop well enough to deal with it, just simple things like windows, for example, that will kind of stop the transmission. And yeah, in Norfolk, places like that, you know, the very kind of boggy places, Norfolk Broads and so on, yes, that malaria was around, existed and was transmitting. I would need to just double check it, but I think it was transmitted in the UK by a parasite that's now extinct. If we were to get enough people coming over with malaria into this country, in the right area, you could get, so unlikely.
And is it linked to the device? Is it linked to just mosquitoes, or can it identify other species? Are you just particularly targeting mosquitoes?
At the moment, we are just targeting mosquitoes. The algorithm are not. They will be tuned for mosquitoes in particular. If I don't know if the audience is interested in the details, but yes. I think. At the moment, the very simple thing that we are doing is to extract two frequency bands from the spectrum with a Goetzel filter, which is a very efficient way of extracting a single bin of a DFT. And we're taking these two frequencies out. One is at the at the central frequency of the mosquito sound, and one is at a frequency where there is no mosquito and hopefully as little background noise as possible. And we take the ratio of these two frequency bands so that this ratio is high in the presence of the mosquito and is kind of around one in the presence of white noise that it covers the entire spectrum, and it should be very low in every other case. And so this is something very simple that it will be improved over time when we have a lot more data. But it doesn't. This is not specific to mosquito, although it's tuned to mosquito. If you see what I mean. So the frequencies that we're looking for are mosquito frequencies. But if you wanted to look for some other sound, that would work as well.
Oh, fantastic! So I could theoretically get a microphone into my thingy. Is this a physical filter or is this a software filter?
It's a software filter.
Okay, cool. I really would love to be able to download this and compile this software myself and just use my own laptop to start getting this information. So
awesome. Yes, absolutely.
Right, is there anything else that I've missed, or do you think that you want to talk about?
There is only one thing that I noticed on your blog post and on the answers, that you're talking about locating a mosquito in a room, right? And I think that's also something very interesting, and it's something that we've been contacted about recently as well. It would be interesting if anyone had any input on how to do that. I think it's not trivial. In theory, you probably only need three microphones, But in practice, this is the technique with sound. Obviously, there might be other ways. I mean, I saw that on a lot of the comments talk about cameras and yes, obviously, would need a quite a high resolution camera, I imagine. But to do it with sound, obviously, it would be possible as well. But what people do, as far as I know, to locate sound is to have a microphone array, so to have a large number of microphones. But yes, if people want to discuss that or, you know, have any ideas of how to do that acoustically, then I think it would be very interesting to explore as well.
Well, I think a good start would be, you know, even if you had one microphone in the room and you could say there is a mosquito in this room somewhere, or there has been a mosquito in this room in the last 10 minutes.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. That's for sure. Something
that at least, you know, you could make a little box with a little red light on it going, there's a mosquito in the room. Okay, I will find this mosquito and I will kill this mosquito.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, absolutely fantastic. Very, very interesting. And I know, like, Dave and all the other people who are listening to this are going, why aren't you asking more questions? So is there, can we follow up again with emails or how can...
Absolutely, we'd be very happy to hear
hit you
from...
on the Twitter account.
Yes, so I will have to find the Twitter handle because it's so bad that I've forgotten what our username is. But it's certainly not just humbug because that was taken already. I think it's humbug mosquito, but I will find that out for you.
Perfect,
and otherwise, please drop us an email from our website, and we'll be happy to get in touch with you.
Well, I'm absolutely astounded at how far you've come with this, and I really personally would love to start messing with this as well, or getting the app. It's really what you're doing is actually really cool science, but the end goal of your project is absolutely fantastic as well, and the fact that you don't want to eradicate all mosquitoes from the planet is also kind of nice. Excellent. Anything else there?
I think that's all from us.
Can I ask just a question that's of interest to me as a father as well? Do you work from home a lot, or how does having a small family how are you getting the work life balance? Is that going okay for you, or is that something you don't want to talk about?
It's okay. It is sometimes it is a bit tricky. I think both of my girls have been to, well, I know that Elsie has been to pretty much every humbug meeting that we've had. Luckily, we work with a group of people who are incredibly generous with, you know, and happy to have me drag Elsie along to most of the meetings. I do work from home a lot as well. What I have to do is I have to work some very long days. That's how I kind of fit my hours in.
Yeah.
And then kind of do childcare for 2 days a week. So 3 days a week. So yeah, it's quite tricky sometimes, but like I said, with the kind of generosity of the other people that I work with, and their very the flexibility that we're allowed at the university as well, it makes life a lot easier than I know for quite a lot of other people. So
I
consider myself very lucky.
Yeah, no, I'm really glad that is the way, and I don't think you. I would like to live in a world where you don't consider yourself lucky, that is the norm. I think,
yeah.
You know, having kids around is just kind of normal. In the way things are now, it's considered odd, but I personally think it's normal, and yeah, that's life. It would be very, very nice to live in a society where, you know, that can happen. So cool, good stuff.
I just found our Twitter handle, if you want, is Humbug Moz. So it's Humbug Moz, MOZZ. So in the future, I think I'll tweet today our first tweet so that we can start our feed.
Excellent, and we'll send some tweets your way as well. Anything else, guys, that I missed?
I don't think so.
No, I think it's very good.
And listen, if you ever want to do a follow-up show yourself, you can just record it and upload it. We're absolutely more than happy to take. We are ourselves an open source, open community. So if you or anybody else want to contribute a show on a particular topic, feel free to do so. We have a mailing list as well if you want to fire up. If you're looking for people to trial anything, we have fairly technical people who listen to us, and they're well used to submitting bug reports and stuff like that. So I'm sure lots of people would be very interested to help.
That is really good to hear, actually. Yeah.
In fact, actually, there is one point that perhaps I should make, but regarding open source, and I think that being open source data, open source work, and that's very much a very important factor of work the group that I've been working with prior to this, and with the Humbug. And I think actually in science as a whole, a lot of the journals that used to be, you used to have to pay to access, are now open access. And that's a movement that's very, very... Sorry. I'm actually kind of trying to wrangle both girls now, so it's not so easy. But I just wanted to make the point that, yeah, that it's really good that science itself and things like your radio show and all this is open access. I just love the fact that things are now accessible to everyone, apart from a supposed elite academic or anything. Everyone can now have a look at all this kind of stuff. It's great to have.
Yes, absolutely.
Very good job of saying what I want to do.
I completely get your point, because right now this is the part that I was stuck on. I was trying to get hold of some academic information as to the frequencies at which mosquitoes operate, and I've made several requests for academic papers from people who have been researching this, and nobody has replied back to me. And then all of a sudden, find out about your project, and boom, you have already the problem solved. And
we wish.
Well, I hope so. Like that, we can at least, you've got an approach that seems, yes, that seems logical, and we can try out, and if it doesn't work, well, that's half the point. That's that in itself is a benefit for the next person who comes along with let's not try that field of research because we know it doesn't work, so let's move on to something else. So I think it's awesome what you're doing, so cool.
Yes, I agree. And I mean, given that the academia is paid by taxpayers' money, I think it's even too late that this is happening, that things are moving towards open source. And there's still a lot of work to do to open more of the academic papers and academic journals and, to free access. And hopefully we will get there one day.
Excellent. Okay, with that, I'll wrap it up, and I'll say, as everybody else who's listening to this, remember, try and contribute some shows. And if you come across an interesting project, just get on the phone, contact them, and you never know, you might be talking to two very nice people on the airwaves. And so I'd like to thank you both again for coming on, and tell our listeners to tune in tomorrow for another exciting episode of Hacker Public Radio.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HBR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club, and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license.